The urban areas of our world constitute mission's new frontiers. Historically, we have thought of missions in a rural framework, in the jungle, missionaries living in huts, working with tribes, translating the scriptures into languages in which the scripture has not been previously translated. But the frontier is moving. It's moving to the great urban centers of the world because that's where people are moving. A study of the projected urban population of the world by the year 2000 indicates that in the United States, 94% of all Americans will live in cities. In Australia, 85%. In the Soviet Union, 80%. In Asia, 60%. In Africa, 45%. In Europe, 82%. And in Latin America, 63%. And so rather than thinking of missionaries as living in grass huts, we need to realize that the average missionary will very likely be living in the 14th floor of an apartment building in a major metropolitan area. This should not shock us if we're familiar with the scriptures. Dr. Donald McGavern pointed out that the Christian religion was born in the city of David and grew to manhood in the great cities of Caesar. Unlike Islam, which became powerful in the small towns and oases of the Arabian hinterland, the expansion of Christianity is inextricably associated with centers of power in the ancient world. Antioch, Ephesus, Corinth, Alexandria, Carthage, Rome. St. Paul evangelized a receptive population, the synagogue communities which lived by commerce in the cities. He traveled from urban center to urban center. 8 of the letters in the New Testament are titled by the names of the urban centers to which they were directed. Cities and larger towns had great meaning for the early church and have even more significance for Christian missions in the next half century. Cities are growing. It is significant to look at the top 10 cities in the world now. The largest city in the world, Tokyo and Yokohama. And then New York City. And if we look further down the list, there's Los Angeles. There's London. There's Paris. These cities about which we have thought when we think of the great cities of the world, the great cities of Europe and North America. But look at the list by the year 2000. New York's still there. What happened to Los Angeles? What happened to Paris? What happened to London? They're off the charts. Because the greatest growth is taking place in those cities which are found in those parts of the world where Christians are fewest. Mexico City, Shanghai, Tokyo, Peking or Beijing, Sao Paulo, Bombay, Calcutta, Jakarta, Rio de Janeiro. How important are cities? Cities are strategic to evangelism for a number of reasons. In the first place, large numbers of people are concentrated there. They're growing. If we're talking about reaching people who don't know Christ, that's where they live. Think of a city like Mexico City. We hear these statistics, 27 million by the year 2000. Some estimates would say that the population of Mexico City is going to be more than 30 million by the year 2000. That's more people than live in the whole country of Canada. Enormous cities. You can take a Miami, and the whole city of Miami is about the growth rate of Mexico City every year. Mexico City absorbs a number of people equal to the number of people who live in Miami every year. And go to a city like Mexico City, and in Mexico City, more than half of the people who live there are 15 years of age or younger. Tremendous explosion in the urban areas of our world. And cities are vital because they bring together people who are part of family networks which extend into the most resistant rural areas of the world. There are people who have left the part of the world where their people group is most concentrated, and they've gone to the city. And there in the city, they can be reached more easily than in their home area, and it provides a link back to the part of the world from which they've come. Networks spread across a nation, but sometimes all around the world. And then think of the influence that the city has in terms of molding the cultural values of a nation. Some people talk about the Los Angelization of the United States, how Los Angeles is a cultural center through the movies in Hollywood and through television, through the media, through all the media that are concentrated there, how it's influenced an entire nation. Cities are centers of enormous influence, and they will influence an entire nation for good or for evil. Then think too about the receptivity of cities. When people move out of rural areas to the cities, they often go with great hope. They go because they're looking for a better way of life, a better job, better medical care, better education for their children. They want the best for themselves. And because they're looking for the best, they're often willing to explore new ways. They'll look at Christianity in a way they've never looked before. And the old social pressures of the village, of the community, be it the priest, be it the in-laws, be it the larger extended family, be it the authorities, they're absent. And so there's a freedom to experiment. And we know that when people come to the city, whether they're drawn to the city by all the attractiveness and the allure of the city, or whether they're simply pushed out of the urban areas because of famine, because of disease, because of poverty, because of unemployment, whatever it is that pushes out with this pull-push or push-pull dynamic that brings people into the cities in such numbers, we know that there's a high degree of receptivity by new people who come to the city, and that people are probably more open to the gospel of Christ during the first 6 months to 3 years of the time they're in the city than in any other time in their life. We know that people who receive help, who come into contact with churches, who are helped by Christians, who hear the gospel during that period of time, the possibility, the chances of their coming to Christ are greater. And so there's a need to prepare to meet people and to encounter them even as they come into the great city areas. We need to be aware when we think of the cities that we must not impose our model of the city in North America, or particularly in the United States, upon the rest of the world. Because when we're thinking city, we're just not talking about the rundown urban centers of large cities, the slums in the middle. In fact, in many of the cities of the world, the best part of the city is the center of the city. And the slums, what are sometimes called the rings of misery, the misery belt, is located in the outskirts of the city, in rings around the outskirts of the city. This is where the rural poor come to establish themselves, in squatters' villages and in urban slums. And so when we're talking urban, we're not just talking inner city ministries. When we're talking about the city, the urban areas of the world being missions' new frontiers, we need to realize we're talking about all these great conglomerations of urban life in its various forms, residential areas, the slums, the central commercial area, the intellectual community and vitality that's there. Cities are strategically important. And receptivity in cities is greater than in any other part of the world. And the bridge is there, because people who come to the city have relatives back in the rural areas, and sometimes the gospel travels in that way. I've personally experienced this, been out in jungle areas in Central America, and discovered that the gospel has reached there because somebody went to the city and was converted and brought the gospel back with them to the village. Strategy for cities has been developed by Dr. McGavern, also by Barrett, and Dr. Ralph Naber has also developed city strategies. McGavern outlined 8 keys to urban church growth, and I'm going to mention those without going into any kind of great detail. McGavern believed that it was important first to emphasize house churches. He wasn't naive. He didn't believe that house churches were the answer, but he believed that house churches were important. Second, He believed that it was important to develop unpaid lay leaders, because that's the only way that the church can multiply given the financial base of poverty-stricken people. Third, he believed that it was important to recognize those homogeneous units which were resistant to the gospel, to recognize resistant homogeneous units and not devote a great deal of time to them, but rather in the fourth place, or the fourth key, would be to focus upon those who are responsive to the gospel. Focus on the responsive. Fifth, he believed that the fifth key was to multiply tribal, caste, and language churches. He recognized, for instance, that in Los Angeles, that Korean churches are probably going to be more successful in winning Koreans to Christ than they are winning long-term Anglo-Saxon residents. And so he promoted ethnic churches. There's nothing wrong with ethnic churches. We don't have to have conglomerate churches which forcibly mix language and cultural and ethnic groups together. Let's multiply tribe and caste and language churches along the lines of the people who come to the city. Sixth, he said it was essential to surmount the property barrier and that the people needed to do this with the resources that they had at hand. Seventh, he believed that it was necessary to communicate intense belief in Christ, that convictions must be convictions of steel and not of rubber. People who are looking for reality in an urban area are not going to be won by half-hearted, apathetic Christians. It's going to take people who are able to communicate intense belief in Christ. And then he believed that it was necessary as part of strategy to provide the theological base for an egalitarian society. In other words, the church in the city needs to place itself firmly on the side of justice. The God who is proclaimed needs to be proclaimed as a God who is just and a God who desires equality for his people. Barrett, in has written extensively on the city. Interestingly enough, he is an Anglican who is working with the Southern Baptist Convention and is helping to formulate strategy for the Southern Baptist Convention through their bold mission thrust. He's working out of Richmond, Virginia, doing tremendous research. Remember, he's the author of the World Christian Encyclopedia, and has developed 10 elements, or list 10 elements for an overall strategy for the dissemination of the gospel. He's concerned not just about church planting, but about the proclamation of the gospel. He speaks first about concrete plans for discipling unreached people. Can't leave plans to be nebulous. They must be concrete. He speaks of deliberate outreach evangelistic projects. Third, he talks about mass outreach projects. Fourth, he insists that missionaries be assigned full-time to these projects, that it's not good enough to tell a missionary, well, you do this in your spare time, or a quarter time, or a half time, because if urban areas are going to be reached, and they're going to be reached through mass outreach projects, they're going to demand full-time missionaries. Fifth, he insists upon full partnership with local churches. Mission societies can't do it alone. Local churches probably can't do it alone. It's going to take a combined effort. He goes on to stress a total outreach to all closed countries. That might be through radio, it might be through literature, it might be through television, but there needs to be an outreach to all closed countries, not just those areas of the world that are receptive. He holds to the importance of interdenominational cooperation. Denominations must work together. They must combine their resources. Next, he underscores the importance for a total knowledge global missions database. Information must be shared. And growing out of that, in ninth, would be a well-publicized, authoritative, factual, state-of-the-world evangelization broadsheet so that people would be able to keep up with the progress of outreach in urban areas. And then denominational statistical reporting in a total Christian context. Denominations sometimes use different bases for reporting statistics. Some include baptized infants. Others include only adults who have been baptized and are in full communion with the church. So he's saying, let's learn to count the same way and to recognize our differences so we really have an accurate picture of how we're doing. Another strategic emphasis comes from Dr. Ralph Naber with his emphasis on cell group churches. Dr. Naber has written many, many books on this subject, and he himself has been involved in the establishment of cell group churches in various parts of the world. By this, he means churches that are basically organized around the cell group structure of a dozen or 15 or so people, which carry on the support and nurture and teaching and fellowship functions of the church. And they're very flexible. They can exist in many neighborhoods and many cultural groups. And then these small groups get together in large celebration services. But the actual day-by-day, week-by-week ministry goes on within the cell groups, where outreach takes place and nurture takes place and leadership is developed. And certainly he can point to some of the largest churches in the world today which are organized along those lines. So Dr. Ralph Naber is one of the leading figures in cell group strategy. And he's a professor of church planting here at Columbia Biblical Seminary and Graduate School of Missions. He divides his time between the United States and Singapore. I interviewed Ralph Naber the last time he was on campus, and I asked him just how the church is responding to the needs of the city.
We are still functioning on a rural model of what church life is like. In my book, Where Do We Go From Here, I show the social structure of a village where you may have two or three different clusters of people. And these people learn how to interact. And you know whether your daughter marries a boy from this kind of a home or not. And you are also taught how to communicate with people from these other clusters in the village. The church in that setting became a cluster church. You had one church for this group of ethnic people. You had another church for this group of people who may have migrated in from Ireland or Italy. And everybody kind of came to terms with each other. So you had little, tiny, cliquey churches who catered only to a certain segment of the population. Then when we went from rural to village or town, we took that pattern along with us, and we began to have four or five Presbyterian or four or five Baptist or four or five Methodist churches, and we came up with the church field, as the evangelicals call it, or the parish, as the more liturgical people call it. And we put these little buildings on corners, and they focused only on a certain group of people in a certain geographical area. Well, you go into a city today, and you have a milieu of people who are interacting at every level, and you no longer have the barriers and the lines. And Martin Marty has said that in the city, the individual develops a privatized religion. He takes a piece of Islam, a piece of Christianity, he takes a chunk of Rosicrucianism, he puts it all together, and that's his religion. And the church is inept in trying to move over all these barriers and interact with all these people. And they're not functioning. The church as we know it today is not only dying, it has to die because it is absolutely useless in the city.
Well, Ralph, what kind of a church needs to rise up in these urban areas in order to meet the need and to take the place of the traditional rural church that too often has just been transplanted into the city?
It's got to be an urban model of the church and not a rural model.
What would that urban model look like?
It's going to require a group of men who strategize to win every segment and branch of a city, from the people who live in the slums to the very wealthy. And it has to be well coordinated. So a pastor doesn't stop in a chunk of the city and say, well, I'm here for Northwest Columbia, and Southeast Columbia doesn't have any impact on me because I'm not responsible for it. In a cell group church, which is the emerging urban world church around the earth today, we have men who strategize, who say, we are going to capture the whole city for God, and we're going to do it from a central strategy. We can plant cell groups among the poor, among the rich, in the north, the south, the east, the west. We can have cell groups that run along the strings of those who are doctors, those who are lawyers. And as we do, we penetrate every nook and cranny of the city. And we all are being built up in Christ to reach out and touch the people that are around us. But our collective witness is a great power witness within urban life because it isn't localized.
Ralph, we all know what happens at 11 o'clock in the morning in a traditional church, but what goes on in a cell group church?
Well, a cell group church in most of the world, and sadly not America, because we are so obsessed with our building on the corner and the program base that we put in the building, but a pure cell group church says every cell is a basic Christian congregation. It exists with the Lordship of Christ. It has its own shepherd. I don't like to use the word pastor or deacon or elder because we get into technical problems, but it has a shepherd. And it never consists of more than 15 people because it is to be community. And this community is to edify. Oikodomeo is the Greek word, to build up one another. I build you up, you build me up, but together we are on mission. So in the traditional church, where you only have 5 to 12% of the people active, in a cell group church you have 95% of the people who are equipped and who are actively pursuing building up one another and touching unbelievers that are in their, what I call oikos, the Greek word for household. And so you have rapid growth. For example, Dion Robert in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, is seeing his cell groups multiply every 2 months and 2 weeks. In an older, more mature and established cell group church in Seoul, Korea, Yonggi Cho's church, or the largest Methodist church in the world, which is a cell group church, or the two largest Presbyterian churches in the world, who are also cell group churches, are seeing growth at about a six-month cycle. In the United States, we are experiencing growth in a well-developed cell group church in 5 months and 2 weeks. In Singapore, where I serve with Faith Community Baptist Church, our first generation of cells multiplied every 9 months. Now we're down to every 4 months. And we have grown from about 360 to over 5,000 in only 4 years. So the life is in the cell, and the cells gather either for congregations or a celebration. And this depends upon the culture. For example, Roger Forster in England is in a very regional part of London. They call them patches, little groups of people that really do feel they belong to each other. In that case, the cell group takes on a congregational effect. And about every 5 or 6 weeks, all of the congregations and cells come together for a massive celebration. In a place like Singapore, where there is no breakdown of the community whatsoever, the people are just scattered and there isn't any section. I live in Bishan there, but to tell somebody I'm in Bishan gives no sense of community. In that case, you have massive celebrations. And that's what Cho has in Seoul, Korea. He has 600,000 members, and he will run over 400,000 now every Sunday. The cell group church in America that I am connected with now is growing. It's getting its act together. But everywhere I go in cell group life, I find people who are touching hell and misery in the lives of others, and it's not fun to do that. It's fun to go to Sunday school and church and go home and eat your dinner and watch TV. But in a cell group church, just last night I'm staying with a cell group family here while I'm teaching. At 2:30 in the morning, the telephone rang, and the whole house was in an uproar because we were in a midnight crisis. And this has been the experience Ruth and I have had for years in cell group church life. It's a way of life. And it's a way of life that does not let you flip a switch and say, I will now minister, and now I will turn it off and go back to living a normal life.
The development of cell group churches are but one of a number of hopeful signs on the urban scene. Pentecostal megachurches are burgeoning in some of the world's major cities. The Christian and Missionary Alliance has developed a strategy to reach the middle classes in Latin America. It's called the Lima al Encuentro con Dios strategy, or the Lima to their encounter with God strategy. Foreign money is used to purchase key property on main thoroughfares and organize a church that's geared to the middle class. Intensive evangelization results in rapid church growth, and then that church becomes a mother church to plant churches throughout the rest of the city. That pattern has been reproduced in some of the other great cities of Latin America as well. Publications are beginning to focus on the city. One of the best such publications is called Urban Mission, and it is produced by Westminster Theological Seminary. Timothy Mansma publishes City Watch, a bulletin, again focusing on the advance of the gospel in the city and bringing to the reader many strategies and ideas, as well as updates on the growth of the church in the city. Training institutions emphasizing the city are coming into being and multiplying, as well as research centers. A poem by George MacDonald sums up the challenge of the city on a very personal basis. He writes, "I said, let me walk in the field. God said, nay, walk in the town. I said, there are no flowers there. He said, no flowers, but a crown. I said, but the sky is black. There's nothing but noise and din. But he wept as he sent me back. There is more, he said. There is sin. I said, but the air is thick and fog is veiling the sun. He answered, yet souls are sick and souls in the dark undone. I said, I shall miss the light and friends will miss me, they say. He answered me, choose tonight if I am to miss you or they. I pleaded for time to be given. He said, it is hard to decide. It will not seem hard in heaven to have followed the steps of your guide. I cast one look at the fields, then set my face to the town. He said, my child, do you yield? Will you leave the flowers for the crown? Then into his hand went mine, and into my heart came he, and I walk in a light divine the path I had feared to see."